ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Over 3 years since the landmark Murphy Report was handed down, Anthony Albanese has announced his government's long-awaited gambling ad reforms. Some, including those within Labor ranks, have welcomed the move, but critics have labelled some of the reforms disappointing, timid, and they've suggested the partial ban isn't enough. The Prime Minister, though, says he's got the balance right. But will his bet pay off? Welcome to Politics Now. I'm Jacob Grieber, filling in for Patricia Karbelis.
And I'm Claire Armstrong, sort of filling in for you, Jacob.
That's very funny when you say it like that. It's like a body swap, isn't it? I hope you brought your swear jar this morning, given the President's current sort of adoption of fruity language, you might say.
Well, as anyone who knows me in the real world, I do tend to have a bit of a potty mouth, but I try to keep things PC when I'm on air or in any kind of public professional forum, like Truth Social, I guess, but, you know,
well,
that's
you
just me.
Yeah, look, if you own your own social media platform, I guess you can swear all you like, which we've discovered from the present. We'll get back to that one. But let's get back to this whole move by the Prime Minister, really just before the Easter long weekend. Some might say it was a bit in the lee of when things wind down and you want to get topics out of the way. You sort of manage them away, usually on a Friday before Christmas or on a Thursday before Easter Friday. Am I being a bit cynical here? What we had from the Prime Minister was the partial winding back of gambling ads. And he's being pushed by people on his own side and by a lot of campaigners to get rid of gambling ads altogether. He's only gone a bit of the way, Claire. Run us through what it is that he's done.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because the PM, when he announced these reforms, was very clear about this is the furthest anyone's gone, which is true when you're coming into a totally unregulated environment. Of course, doing anything is going to be more than the status quo. But essentially what we've had from the Prime Minister is attempts at rolling back gambling advertisements and promotions across a range of platforms. On television, between the hours of 6 a.m. and 8:30 p.m., there'll be a limit to 3 ads per hour. The radio broadcast will not be able to broadcast ads during like classic school pickup drop-off times. And online, it will essentially be age-gated, so you can't advertise to people under 18, and people who are over 18 will be able to opt out from seeing gambling ads. That's kind of the core changes. There's some crackdown on illegal offshore gambling websites. But in terms of the core kind of intent of this reform package, which is reducing exposure to gambling advertising, the way that the government has calibrated this essentially is very geared toward children. The other thing I should mention is they've stripped, there won't be any gambling advertisements in stadiums or on the jerseys of players. So ostensibly, if all of these reforms are delivered, you as a parent could watch the footy on TV with your child or go to a game and get through that entire experience without them being exposed to gambling advertisements. The point that advocates who want much tougher reforms make is while it's obviously very important to not normalise gambling and sports for a new generation, there is an entire existing generation of adults who are losing billions and billions of dollars a year to gambling, and that perhaps some of these restrictions, particularly the complete sort of absence really of any restriction on online gambling advertising to over 18s, is not anywhere near what was needed to kind of deal with this problem.
So let's talk about the political fallout from that. The Prime Minister, as you said, he's talking it up, saying no government has done more, but off a low base. You have the industry saying there's some complexities here. You have sports administrators saying this is the bread and butter. This is the lifeblood of a lot of support for sports. This is how they make their money. And there's no obvious industry or candidate that can come in and replace them. So the Prime Minister's landed on this position that, look, it's not the first time he's sort of come to a half-pregnant sort of position, which is what critics would say of where he's landed. I spoke to Tim Costello when the news was announced. He had a sort of real wariness about it. He was sort of, well, look, it's better than nothing, but it's very timid. It doesn't go anywhere near as far as what was recommended in the Murphy Review. Is that tenable? Has this now gone on so long, do you think, Claire? And people have famously talked about it's 1,000 days, more than 1,000 days, or 3 years since that report came out. In the last term, it was very much one of those issues that kept getting kicked down the road, I felt. Now they finally said, yes, we're going to act. Why do you think he's done that now rather than, I don't know, 6 months from now or had done it earlier?
I have a few opinions / insights into this. One of the things that is coming up on the horizon for Labor is their national conference. That'll be in July. It's been put to me that this is like a once in a term thing, like all the Labor heavyweights, power brokers, members come together and they hash out the party's national platform. And that sort of sets the tone, the theme, the focus, sometimes quite specifically steps out policy priorities for the Federal Labor Party. It's a blueprint, if you will, for the parliamentary Labor members to go out and implement. It's been put to me that this upcoming national conference was going to be broadly about the three Gs: gas, Gaza, and gambling. Gaza being a bit of a clever catch-all for everything that's going on in the Middle East at the moment. Gas, obviously a gas tax. But gambling has been on the agenda and growing for a while. There has been a concerted grassroots movement of branches across the country looking at putting up motions to have some kind of reform in this area, take that to state conferences, and basically then have a big brawl over this issue in July. That is not something that the Prime Minister would want. So I think it was always the case that he was going to have to take something to national conference. I think it is pretty disappointing that he chose to make that announcement at the 11th hour before a long weekend in the middle of a global oil crisis, in the back end of a speech that was ostensibly about a totally different topic. You said before, the colloquial term for it is taking out the trash. And it really did feel like he was taking out the trash. He'd probably dispute that. You know, he announced the policy on national television, but I haven't seen anyone talking about it since it was announced. I'm glad that we are. So the politics for him, it's not all about national conference, but it shows that there'd been this pressure building and there was a bit of a ticking time bomb. Why he didn't act earlier? Well, Yorgos's guess is as good as mine. This package is actually not as strong as the one that former Communications Minister Michelle Rowland was rumoured to be working up last term. Now, it was put to me by a person inside Labor, and the interesting thing about how a lot of the Labor MPs have handled this issue is that they have decided to be very disciplined publicly and only sort of agitate internally on this. So they don't speak out publicly on this issue. But it was put to me that that original tougher proposal was friendless. It set the movement back years. They're only now getting back on track with a slightly weaker version, and that it's a step in the right direction, and that's the approach that they've taken. It's not job done, but it's where they've got to get to. I think it's a bit naive to think that the Prime Minister's ever going to revisit this issue ever again once this legislation passes, but that's my big take on this. You can tell I've been in the weeds.
Well, it's one of those ones where if you get something across the line, it takes the heat out of it, even though a lot of the advocates say it goes nowhere near far enough. One of the interesting that struck me, and it was again pointed out to me by Tim Costello, is that even going this far is an acknowledgement by the Prime Minister that gambling causes harm to young people, because the ban will come in and it'll be 3 advertisements an hour, I believe, as you said, and then also those restrictions around drop-offs time. So that's, in essence, that is Parliament, if it passes, acknowledging that there is a problem here. But it's also a bit like saying 3 ads for, say, cigarettes an hour is also acceptable. Is this tenable, this sort of having it both ways on this issue, when you are acknowledging that these ads are causing a problem, particularly for young people?
Yeah, it's really difficult because the government obviously is acknowledging there's this health issue here, not unlike something like cigarettes. We know there are health impacts of gambling addiction.
Or the social media ban.
Exactly. I think the complexity of this issue is obviously, as you say, that the sporting codes are pretty reliant on this income, and that a lot of adults feel that they, you know, the Prime Minister always says, we're not trying to stop people having a punt. There are a lot of adults who obviously feel in control of the way that they engage with and take part in gambling and don't want that completely removed. I think, I mean, they can still do all of that without it being advertised to them, so I'm not entirely sure how far that argument goes. But I think what's interesting is you see people like David Pocock, who's been very strong on this, pointing to some research that ACMA, the regulator, did around partial bans, essentially finding that where advertising is only restricted in some situations, you kind of just see it flourish wherever it isn't restricted. The Prime Minister would argue that he's restricted it sufficiently. I would be surprised. I luckily have an algorithm that doesn't throw a lot of gambling content at my feeds, but I'm sure a lot of people are probably going to find that once advertising is removed from some of those other spaces, it does crop up a lot more online. And I'm interested in the conversation we're going to have with Meta, Google, TikTok. Is there going to have to be an on-off switch within each platform to opt out of this gambling advertising? I'm not saying it's not physically possible, but we're having about a 17-front fight with,
indeed,
with
yeah.
social media companies at the moment. Are we adding an 18th front, which is you must allow people to opt out of gambling advertising? I don't know.
Just before we move off the gambling thing, and I'd recommend listeners have a look at Claire's piece on the ABC website under the analysis clicker button thing, whatever you call that in tech terms, website terms, Albanese's big gambling on betting industry restrictions. You really go through the details there that we've been discussing. But the last final sort of question in my mind is, what's the pathway for this through Parliament? Does it need Parliament? Can it be done by regulation? And if it goes through Parliament, who's going to support this?
This is tricky. It's legislation. It's going to need either the Greens or the Coalition. And both, in reaction to this on Thursday, essentially said, we need to see the details. We're concerned that this doesn't go far enough. I think it will be difficult to sort of let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. It depends on how seriously either of those two groups believe that there's a chance to revisit this down the track or not. I think it'll end up passing through one of those two pathways.
Because from the Coalition's point of view, I'm just thinking it through, they would probably like to be seen to be doing the right thing from the healthcare point of view, from the mental health care point of view, but they also would have the same advocates from the industry, from the sporting groups, pushing them to make it a package that doesn't unwind the ability for those companies to actually do the advertising.
Absolutely. And this is an issue that has been at the forefront of coalition policy. It was in, I think, Peter Dutton's first budget in reply speech was he announced, well ahead of Labor, an intention to legislate restrictions around gambling advertising, particularly around sports games. So this is actually something that they have been sort of involved in for some time, and I suspect that they'll ultimately decide this lands about where they're comfortable with.
So we're sitting here Monday morning, Easter Monday, probably still getting over the chocolate
highs. Much chocolate.
Yes, there's still some lying around the office, and I just had to say, no, not today. Not today, Easter egg. Leave me alone.
The pre-midday Easter egg.
Exactly. Here we are. We've had this long weekend. Australians are coming back today. They're getting ready for work. The sense before the Easter weekend was, will this global shock to fuel prices lead to the unavailability of fuel in the various places that people like to go during Easter? I think there was real anxiety around last week. Can I still have my Easter holiday? Can I do the things I normally do at this time of year? Or do I have to cancel? The Prime Minister on Wednesday gave an address to the nation and told people, no, stick to your plans. I don't know if you got away over the weekend. Did you notice people change their plans? Did it feel different? What was the vibe like?
I will admit that after four parliamentary sitting weeks in the last five, I kind of was a massive hermit and didn't really leave, like, between my house, the gym and the supermarket. However, I am a journalist, so that means I talk to people. And I am told things like bookings for holiday park homes, all of the sort of normal metrics that you'd expect of indicative of if people have changed their behaviour, were pretty steady. Mm. So it sounds like in the main, everyone sort of got the Easter they wanted to, albeit it was probably a lot more expensive than they had hoped. Interestingly, we've had the latest sort of daily update of petrol station fuel availability from Energy Minister Chris Bowen, and it was a couple hundred without diesel and about 400 and something total without either without at least one fuel type. That's a bit lower than what we've seen in the last few weeks. So suggests to me that either everyone's tanks are full and there's nowhere for that petrol to go, or that panic maybe has subsided. Or my third theory is that they're waiting for that fuel excise cut to really take effect and they'll capitalise on the cheaper fuel then.
Well, we did get, yes, we've had some updates, haven't we? Not only there's not as many empty fuel stations, there was a 30% increase in demand over Easter compared to last year. So it definitely looks like people were on the road buying fuel. In fact, 30% more on last year's Easter is a huge jump. And yet it seems to have been delivered to those customers without any real dislocation that I can see at this point. And I was down on the south coast of New South Wales, and I have to say it was full. The restaurants were full. You had to book well in advance to get in. The activities that people were doing still seem to be happening. So it does feel like that whole thing was managed. People got where they needed to go. And I think there's a bit of good news around on this. Chris Bowen this morning, the Energy and Climate Change Minister, has been out and about giving a number of interviews. He's now saying that with all the shipments coming from overseas, it all looks pretty good for the rest of April into May. And that's a bit of a change on where the government was even last week, where there was a lot of talk that it's all fine for now, but once you get into the second half of April, there are gaps starting to open up. And I felt that they were preparing the country a little bit for a clampdown after Easter. I wonder whether that's needed now, with Bowen now saying things are looking okay into May. And he's talking about ships that are on the water coming this way.
Yeah, well into May were his words. He wouldn't exactly put a specific date on it. But it does seem, and as you say, there's this lead time on ships arriving. Once they're heading this way, that sort of 4 to 6 weeks, depending on where they're coming from. I mean, unless some real crazy intervention happens and they detour and don't turn up, we sort of know they're coming.
Unless there's sort of piracy going on.
Yeah, on the high seas.
And people are stealing ships.
So I do think, yeah, essentially the way Bowen has explained it before makes sense to me, at least. With every day or week that passes, we know more and more in advance that these ships are coming because they're physically on the way. I wouldn't underestimate, there has been quite a diplomatic effort underway behind the scenes to all of our main kind of partners that we trade with. It's not totally this transactional, but there is obviously the added benefit that Australia has of being a major exporter of LNG gas. That is something that the rest of the world wants, often the parts of the world that are sending us refined fuel. So that's a bit of a good way to ensure that countries are still talking and reassuring each other of supply chains. So I do think there's work been underway from the government. We don't yet know the extent to which the underwriting offer to underwrite those shipments of fuel has been implemented. That's quite interesting, I think, to see in the next couple of weeks. But, I mean, potentially, we are actually just managing this. The question, as you know, we flagged at the top of this, depends on how long this all goes for and how bad it gets in the meantime, because we are kind of reliant on Mr. Trump for that.
And we'll get to him and his sweary mouth in a second. But it is definitely the case there's a lot of diplomatic work going into all of this. Australia has the capacity to pay for fuel as a country, given where prices are, and probably even when they go a little higher, if they do indeed go higher. The question is more, how do we manage that? And you've alluded to this sort of stick that we've got in the form of our exports. I think the risky part for the government here is any suggestion that Australia would withhold energy exports as a way to force some other country to deliver more. I don't think we're at that stage. That's a real deterioration if it becomes as explicit like that. But it is interesting. I mean, there are reports in Japan that the new Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, is on her way to Australia.
Yep.
And you can be sure that gas is 100% at the top of her
agenda. Second and third priority.
Because they rely on a lot of gas out of the Gulf. That's now in serious trouble. Not just if the war's over soon. Some of the gas supplies out of Qatar will be affected for years to come because it takes such a long time to rebuild that infrastructure that's been damaged.
Absolutely. And we've got our Prime Minister heading to Singapore later in the week, similarly sort of shoring up these sorts of relations. My understanding of a lot of the engagement between Australia and our partners in the region has been it's one of very much like collective assurance. Like everyone's just really happy to be talking to each other and reaffirming their commitment to current, you know, situation. I think that's really like actually probably the best case. No one's needed to say, oh, well, you know, just a reminder, we can cause problems for you if you cause problems for us. It's just been a bit of like collective clinging to each other and holding on through this storm.
Well, it's become a team alliances or team trading partners rather than a Team Australia thing. It feels like maybe there's a bit of a lesson there from COVID. The difference being, of course, that we're not talking about face masks and medical equipment.
We're
talking about the very thing that keeps all the economies that we're talking about going. So on this question of how long it all lasts, and that's the question we always ask every day pretty much in this business, and I'm sure people at home are doing the same thing. What we know over the weekend, the Americans conducted a successful mission, we're told, to recover the downed pilot. There were two aircraft shot down on Friday, and there was one of the pilots had not been recovered until the last several hours. And Trump's sort of claiming that as a big win. It would have been a real political propaganda coup for Iran if they had captured this pilot. And now he's out on his own social media platform demanding in very fruity language, purple language, that Iran reopen the Straits of Hormuz. Is that going to work?
I don't think you need to be an expert in international relations to say no, Jacob.
I don't think that will work. And what's it broadcasting, do you think?
I mean, this has been discussed a lot. I know he's a teetotaler, but didn't he just come across like he just had a few too many wines celebrating the rescue of... And as an aside, the rescue of this pilot is a fascinating story. If you have too much time on the rest of your long weekend, I highly recommend going and deep diving into this. The CIA involvement, this guy's hiding in like a mountain crevice, and they've like done these distractions to make the Iranians think they've already got him, so they stop looking. It's pretty cool. So I imagine Trump is riding high, gets on the old Truth Social. I have to admit, I first saw this in the form of a screenshot and I thought it was like a delayed April Fool's. It was just like making its way to my phone a few days late. And I had to go and actually check on Truth Social that this was legitimate, that he had said, open the effing straight.
I'm so glad you said it, because I'm far too polite to say something
like
that.
Well, I didn't say it how he said it. Although how he said it was very weird as well.
Does it not just reek of complete impotence and frustration that
totally
you would say such a
desperate.
Thing?
It was so desperate. And that is terrifying. Because, I mean, it is true that the US, you know, for all of their talk of the sort of end of their hegemony, they have superior military power here. They have huge economic influence, huge diplomatic influence, as much as that's being eroded. To resort to that on that platform, I just think, like, wouldn't you, I mean, I'm embarrassed and I'm not an American. Wouldn't you wake up that morning as an American and just think, oh my God.
It's not only that, it's also, is he doing it, you sort of have to assume that there's purpose behind some of this.
No, there's no 4D chess here.
And I love the gag that many others have made about that, which is that he's not playing 4D chess, he's eating the chess pieces. That's not my joke, but it's a very funny one. But is he just winding it up because tomorrow is yet another one of these deadlines that he's declared? Tomorrow is going to be bridges and energy facilities, which, I mean, if you're actively targeting things that are relied on by the
civilians,
you're in the realm here of
war crimes.
Right.
I think this increasingly puts countries like Australia, if it's possible, to be in any more of an uncomfortable position in relation to the legal questions around this war. If we are at a point that the US genuinely starts targeting these civilian infrastructure. And in the past, he's talked about things like water desalination plants. Like, that is getting deep into the realm of civilian infrastructure in a way that is, you know, bridges are inconvenient and they cut off communities and all of these things, but like no fresh drinking water, that's existential. That's really concerning. And I think we are not that far away from Australia, the UK, Canada, others really probably having to do something with that whole coalition of the willing and start pushing back in a concerted way about that messaging. Because you know what we've been doing for the last 4 years? Complaining, rightly so, about Vladimir Putin targeting energy infrastructure in Ukraine. Like, we have our own battles to fight on this issue, and to have someone in our corner essentially using it as a threat is really problematic beyond the sphere of the Middle East for Australia.
And I think you could see that with that UK-led coalition at the end of last week. There were 40 countries, including Penny Wong, who got on that call.
Penny Wong, her own country.
Countries represented by everyone, including Penny Wong, to be clear. And they're looking at what possible pressure can be brought to bear on Iran to reopen the strait. Because the last thing you want is a scenario where Trump says, I'm done, but the straits are not actually open to free trade as they have been. Very, very problematic. And that's being left, I think, unresolved. The point you make about the way this war is seemingly escalating into very, very questionable realms does put the focus back on us and what we're doing there. And the Prime Minister's been, he's been reiterating that Australia is not an active participant in this war, but we do have important equipment like a wedge tail, which mm-hmm. is the eyes and ears being used by, we're told, the UAE and other Gulf states to help protect themselves against Iranian rocket attacks. And then we had this very interesting report last week, which the government hasn't apparently, to my knowledge, shot down.
They've just said they don't comment.
It was in the Daily Telegraph. It was a report that Australian SAS troops were deployed several weeks ago, it now seems, to the airbase. I think it's the one in Bahrain. Is that right?
I think it was Al Minhad in the UAE, although if we still have people there, I'd be surprised.
And really, it's there about they seem to have been there to assist with maybe, what is it, extraction of Australian personnel or security of Australians in the region, rather than, there's no suggestion, I don't think, at this stage that they're involved in anything offensive.
No.
But where's the line? That's
well,
the question.
That report definitely said that whatever role or intent in their deployment was defensive, but those lines obviously blur quite easily in this kind of complex theater of war. I don't think it's unusual that we would have forward positioned, like these are our kind of elite people. I don't think it's unusual that we might have forward positioned them, particularly when you think back to a few weeks ago and we had thousands of Australians stranded, particularly the ones just in transit in that region trying to get to or from wherever they were going and back to Australia. I think it's probably understandable. I am surprised that the government hasn't talked about it now that it's out there and tried to actually frame it a bit better, because I do think it's now left open to the imagination. And I do think it's a danger that if we have this deployment sitting there that, you know, it raises more questions about the extent of our involvement and what our involvement could become in this war.
I agree with you, Claire. I think they should be providing us more information where they can. And obviously there's a limit from an operational point of view, but that's always an excuse.
I don't need their names and numbers.
Yeah, that's always an excuse the government hides behind. And then lo and behold, people like you and me usually find out what's happening from an American Pentagon source who tend to be more forthcoming on this. And I think the government does need to come and explain what this involvement is about. Because the Defence Minister, Richard Miles, has been clear, we are not having boots on the ground in Iran. He didn't say boots on the ground in other parts of the Gulf. And he's made it clear that the government is supporting countries in the Gulf. So I think the public does deserve, you know, a little clarity around this. Claire, we'll have to wrap it up here. I'm getting a sense that we might have blown the time budget. There's still plenty of other things going on. The week ahead, Parliament's not sitting, but I think this fuel issue is going to continue to dominate the debate, people's concerns, but There's been a bit of good news today, I think you'd have to say, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I hope people are feeling a little bit more relaxed and sure about the situation. But that is obviously only in terms of their ability to do their daily lives. There's still the cost factor on construction, on farming, you know, all of those things that are going to play out for months and months because of the import costs going up into a lot of those operations. So it's definitely, this is it for the year. I feel like I've said that a few times already this year, but this issue and its flow-on effects really is the year for us.
It totally is. Folks, that's it for Politics Now today. Thanks for joining me, Claire.
Thanks for letting me fill in for you.
You did a great job.
Thanks. You did a great job as PK.
Tomorrow, Tom Crowley will be joining me for the latest developments. And if you have a question for us, please send a short voice note to theparty@abc.net.au.